From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Soon after the collapse of the Twin Towers, mea culpas fell like gentle rain from the lips of news producers. CNN chairman Walter Isaacson said the attacks helped his network rediscover, quote, its true mission to cover international news in a serious way. Of course, CNN had only recently misplaced its mission in response to the siphoning of its ratings by the more entertaining, less newsy Fox. But the big three broadcast networks had left the true path a long time ago. Here's a number, in case you needed it. In the 1970s, according to a Harvard study, networks devoted about 45% of their newscasts to foreign affairs. That fell to 13.5% by 1995. But after September 11th, the networks awoke to the idea that they could serve the public better. It's been 6 months now. How are they doing?
A good measure for coverage of foreign news is how many minutes of time on the network nightly news is filed with a foreign dateline. In other words, not with a voiceover of footage from abroad, but you've actually sent a correspondent abroad. Mm-hmm. And pre and post September 11th, you've virtually doubled the amount of foreign coverage.
Andrew Tindall, author of the Tindall Report, spends his days doing the numbers on the network's nightly news. He says foreign coverage rose from 10 to 20% of the newscast in the last 6 months, due, of course, to the war on terror and related stories. That makes sense. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict also received ample airtime, but Tindall says it always does. 105 minutes in the 5 months before September 11th, 108 minutes in the 5 months after. But what about the rest of the world?
The big stories that have happened that should have been covered more heavily and weren't because of the concentration on Central Asia were the economic crisis in Argentina, the volcano in the Congo, the elections in Zimbabwe, where there have been virtual riots and looting and suppression of democracy.
And do you anticipate they would have gotten heavy coverage if the networks hadn't been concentrating on Afghanistan?
No. It wasn't that there were resources that were diverted from those stories to Afghanistan. It was that the resources would never have been there to cover those in the first place.
Bill Wheatley is the vice president of NBC News.
Television news is a lot more extensive than simply evening news programs, and we should always remember that. I'm the former executive producer of the NBC Nightly News, and it has a very soft spot in my heart. But television is far bigger than that now.
Consider news magazines like 60 Minutes, Dateline, and Nightline, for now anyway, and leave out of this discussion the issue of 24-hour cable news channels. Still, according to TV Guide's Max Robbins, the network news magazines didn't behave much differently than the evening newscasts in the last 6 months.
If you look at the news magazine shows, before September 11th, about 7-8% of their total time they spent on stories was on international stories. Post-September 11th, that amount doubled.
And that coverage, too, was mostly related to the war. The fact is, foreign news gets relatively short shrift unless American lives are at stake. Network chiefs note the tune-out of foreign stories, and a Gallup poll found that the number of people who declared themselves hardly interested in foreign news jumped from 3 to 22% between 1990 and 1998. And the reason for that, says Michael Parks, former L.A. Times editor and current head of the University of Southern California School of Journalism, is that the old hands cover it the old way, with too much emphasis on politics and too little on real life.
The Cold War is over, and thus the public feels less apprehension about a confrontation with the Soviet Union. And they're more interested in what we can learn about solutions to our problems in terms of other countries. Does the death penalty work in deterring crime? Well, let's take a look at China.
In a world where boundaries are blurred by a global economy, ease of travel, and cross-border concerns about disease and the environment, foreign news only seems foreign when it's covered that way.
If you look at the amount of attention that was given, say, to the introduction of the euro in Europe, agreed, a very important economic story. But weigh that against the coverage of international terrorism prior to September 11th. And you can see the disproportions.
It may be that 9/11 offered no lessons to the networks because, once again, lives were at stake, a lot of lives, so the old rules applied.
I do not believe that there will be any lasting impact from 9/11 on the way foreign news is regarded, either by the audience or by the people who cover the news, no.
Paul Friedman is the executive vice president of ABC News. He doesn't see a problem, and he disputes Park's assertion that, for instance, the terrorist threat wasn't adequately covered, by his network anyway. He suggests that if there's a lesson here, it's the public's to learn.
People did not pay much attention because it didn't seem real to them. It didn't feel real to them until it happened.
But Parks points to a study conducted prior to September 11th last year by the Pew Research Center and the Council on Foreign Relations, in which the public ranked protecting the U.S. from terrorist attack as the country's top foreign policy priority. And he adds that any apathy evinced by the public is the fault of a vicious cycle perpetuated by the networks.
People aren't interested in international news, therefore we're going to give them less. Well, the less you give them, the less interested they are. The professional burden on us is to persuade people to read and to watch what they need to know to be active citizens in our democracy.
I just don't think that that's the way we think. I don't think we say we're putting something on TV and whether you watch it or not, we're putting it on anyway.
We spoke to Marcy McGinnis, vice president of news coverage for CBS, last September.
You know, if you're Kmart and you say, I'm going to sell mink coats and nobody in Kmart buys them, Kmart goes out of business.
As the proliferation of cable news outlets lifts the burden of public service off the networks, top-flight foreign news begins to look like mink coats at Kmart. The availability of those coats looks increasingly uncertain. Then again, so does the future of Kmart.
In a press conference Thursday, Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf shocked many in the West by saying murdered Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl had been over-intrusive in his reporting. Journalists, he advised, need to be more cautious about what they dig into. Musharraf's statement was the latest blow to press freedom in Pakistan, which previously tolerated aggressive journalism, and the situation is worsening. Shaheen Sabai was the editor of The News, an influential daily in Pakistan. He resigned last week under pressure after various government ministries demanded that The News cease its investigations into links between Islamic terrorists and the government. The authorities were particularly upset over a report that Sheikh Omar, the chief suspect in the Pearl murder, had ties with the Pakistani intelligence agency and was involved in the December 13th attack on the Indian parliament. Shaheen Sabai joins us now. Mr. Sabai, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me, sir.
How is the Musharraf government actually carrying out the silencing of the press? How did they intimidate your newspaper?
First of all, when one of the key reporters, who is also reporting for the Washington Post from Karachi, when he filed a story in the evening about Sheikh Omar's interrogation, the intelligence agencies broke into our system and found that story. So they started calling up everybody, including me, at 1 in the morning to pull that story out. I refused. I said, no, I can't do that. So they went to my publishers and other people, and they were successful in pulling it out from some of the editions in other languages, not in the English language. Next day, when my newspaper published the whole story, they were really furious, and they cut out the government revenues for the entire group of newspapers. Now, this is the largest newspaper group in Pakistan. It has about 12 daily newspapers coming out from 5 different cities every day.
What percentage of the newspaper group's revenues come from government advertising?
Oh, it's more than 50%. The private sector is already down. The economy is in a financial crunch. So all the media depends mostly on the government revenues.
Now, I couldn't help but notice that your resignation wasn't filed until you had left the country.
Yes.
Do you have reason to think that you are in some kind of physical danger, or that the intelligence services or forces within the intelligence services will take some sort of revenge against you personally?
Absolutely, yes. That was the reason I first left the country, and then I resigned and did what I did. Because I have a experience of at least three times in the past 10 years that I had been physically attacked, actually attacked. Once they broke into my house and pulled out guns on the head of my sons and threatened them. So I knew that if I took this stand, they'll come after me one way or the other. So the best thing was to get out, be safe, and then do whatever.
Those previous confrontations with security services, did they occur under Musharraf's regime or under the previous one?
No. They were not under Musharraf. Those three occasions, they were under political governments. But basically, it were the agencies who were doing that, and I knew how they operated and how they went after people, because I was not the only one. There have been a number of cases in Pakistan where the agencies have been hounding journalists who would not get in line.
So irrespective of which government happens to be in power, the security agencies, the ISI, that's a constant.
Well, the ISI, and there are others also. They come after you in the same pattern, whether it's a military government or a civilian government, or they chase you, they block your telephones, they block your houses, and they beat you up. And if you are too stubborn, they beat up your family. So that I couldn't risk anymore.
Now, on this show in the past, we have talked to various Pakistani journalists about the extraordinary freedom of the press, considering that the Musharraf regime took power in a military coup and is fundamentally a dictatorship. Why this sudden clamping down on the press?
If you have to keep in mind that Mr. Musharraf is going into an election, what he is trying to do is to build a political party around him, and they want this party to win a huge majority in the election so that he can legitimize himself politically through a political process, although he came as a military dictator. So for that goal in end, probably they have to manage the media. And that's what I fear, that this is going to grow as time goes.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Shaheen Sabai is the former editor of the News of Pakistan.
Coming up, how much government supervision does the Internet need? And how much privacy do celebrities need?
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Many a politician has praised the virtues of a hands-off policy with regard to the net. But recently, Washington regulators and lawmakers have been weighing in on America's future online. Thomas Weber, who writes the eWorld column for The Wall Street Journal, says the politicians are out of their depth. He says the best example of political meddling is the controversial Tozen-Dingell bill that passed the House a couple of weeks ago. If it passes the Senate, the Tozen-Dingell bill would overturn a law that currently requires local phone companies, fondly called the Baby Bells, to open their phone lines to competitors before they offer high-speed data services. Why are some policymakers now so eager to re-regulate the world of high-speed Internet access? Weber says the reason is clear.
right now, anything that's broadband and anything that could possibly spur economic growth in some sense of the word is an easy sell.
What is broadband?
Broadband, to you and me, is getting on the internet at a high speed, like a cable modem or a DSL line. But there's super ultra high speed broadband with fiber optics that universities use and businesses use. And believe it or not, part of the debate in Washington right now claims that even though a pretty good chunk of America can get broadband already, and apparently not that many people feel like they want to spend the extra money for it, it's too slow. That's why people aren't buying it.
So Tozan Dinglebill and its proponents say, we can provide even faster service that the public may or may not buy if we lift this restriction from the baby bill. So how would that work?
Well, the rosy thinking goes, okay, we take these restrictions off, and suddenly the bells will start writing checks to Cisco and Intel and, you know, all these companies on the West Coast, and that will help the economy. The bells, historically, have not really done anything unless there was a competitive threat to them. DSL is this decades-old technology that basically sat on the shelf for a while until the cable companies said, gee, you know, we could offer fast internet access over these cable lines. When they started actually rolling that out, all of a sudden DSL got very interesting to the bells. And by the way, even though Tozan Dingell isn't expected to get through the Senate, over at the FCC, they're working on a proposal that would do the same thing, basically, as Tozan Dingell.
You've complained in your article that the government meddles too much in the affairs of the net. So isn't this the government stepping away and letting the market take over by lifting this restriction?
Not when you're talking about the phone company. I mean, if you wanted to unravel the regulations governing the phone company, you'd have to go back decades and decades, and it's going to be a lot more complicated than just Tozan Dingell.
Congress, though, isn't the only part of the government that's been getting entangled in these issues. The Copyright Office is considering a new way to tackle unauthorized online radio shows, broadcasting of music.
I don't even like to think about this Copyright Office situation because it just makes me feel sick. The fact is, most of the people who are doing it, they don't have big audiences. They have their friends and their family and some fans they hear from word of mouth.
Well, all the Copyright Office is doing is demanding that they pay some sort of royalty to the music companies.
An amount that's twice what professional radio stations are going to have to pay.
We have a recession. We have a high-tech industry that is perhaps sliding on the skids, although that may be overstating things a bit. We have these moves to lift restrictions in order to invigorate the industry and to protect the creative property of musicians and possibly filmmakers, Hollywood. Summarize where you think all the moves you've just described are going to take us.
I think we're headed into a period where government regulation on the internet is going to favor the established big guys and is going to be very hurtful to the little guys.
We had somebody on recently representing the cable companies who said, the little guy, there's nothing wrong with big.
Big isn't bad with some sort of market activity in place, but I think you should look at what's going on in music right now and say, hey, consumers have spoken. They don't like paying $16 for a CD. They think they should pay maybe 10 bucks a month and get all the music they want to listen to. That's the market in action. Maybe we should just let the market take over everything.
We don't allow such expressions of unrestrained capitalism on this program.
Fortunately, at the Wall Street Journal, they certainly do.
Thank you very much. Thomas Weber writes the eWorld column for the Wall Street Journal.
College basketball coach Bobby Knight is legendary for his profane on-court fulminations and his off-court battles with the press. Both were documented in John Feinstein's 1989 bestseller, A Season on the Brink. Now that book has been turned into a TV movie, airing on ESPN. Feinstein calls the adaptation a cartoon, And ESPN anchor Dan Patrick isn't wild about having a fictionalized biopic aired right after journalistic coverage of the NCAA basketball tournament selection process. Here's Patrick on his ESPN radio show.
I don't agree with the movie. I wish we weren't doing the movie, but we are.
If the mixing of news and entertainment affects anybody, it would probably be ESPN reporter Jeremy Schapp, who already covers Coach Knight without being on speaking terms with him. We asked Schapp if the ESPN foray into semi-fiction presents journalistic problems for him.
I don't think it affects my job at all. I think that Bob and most people are savvy enough to understand that there is a distinction between our news division, as it were, and the people who are producing the movies that we are now going to be producing, I understand, on a fairly regular basis. But my bosses, I have to give them credit, have always kept up the firewall and have tried to make the best of apparent conflicts of interest. I mean, remember, I work for ESPN, which has billion-dollar relationships with the NFL, with Major League Baseball, now with the NBA, with the NHL, and I don't think it's affected the way that reporters such as myself cover those leagues. Remember, we're also owned by Disney, which owns the Anaheim Angels and the Anaheim Mighty Ducks.
In other words, you're constantly interviewing your business partners as news sources.
Exactly.
But is there a clear-cut firewall between, say, SportsCenter and the sports programming that people understand between the news divisions at the major networks and their entertainment sides?
Well, I think it may be more blurred at ESPN. That's certainly the case because this movie in particular has been so heavily promoted and promoted so frequently on SportsCenter that we should be careful about that.
Ever since Bobby Knight began making the news through his chair throwing and athlete choking and so forth, he said, "The media is out to get me." And the media have always been able to say, well, actually, no, Bobby. I mean, we've got documentary evidence that you've done this, that, and that. It's on tape. But now he can actually point and say, they are out to get me. Look at this stuff they've made up about me. Make your job harder?
No, I don't think so. I don't think there's anything in there reproduced dramatically that did not happen that would be controversial. It's not as if there's a scene in there with him choking a kid that didn't happen. You know, most people who've seen A Season on the Brink or who've read the book came away in some ways admiring Bob Knight. That was something that always infuriated him because he hated the book. He thought it made him look like a bully, too profane. And of course, all those things he is doesn't mean that he wanted to be portrayed that way.
Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeremy Schapp is a reporter for ESPN.
The popular end of Britain's newspaper market is also the sharp end, and the pressure is always on to bring readers in with the hottest celebrity gossip. But spare a thought for the UK's tabloid journalists, who operate in an environment that is heavily controlled compared to here in the US. And soon, British newspapers will be subject to even more regulation. Gareth Mitchell has been investigating the story from London.
Naomi Campbell is one of Britain's biggest superstars. On the way up, she's had a healthy marriage with the tabloid newspapers. They've loved her looks and her glamorous lifestyle, and she's loved all the publicity. Now, that relationship has hit rocky times. Journalist and writer Chris Horry is an expert on Britain's tabloids, and he's been following the Naomi story.
Naomi Campbell was seen going to a drug rehabilitation clinic in London, and the Daily Mirror simply wrote about it. They took pictures of her going into the clinic. Nothing libelous about that because it's true. Her objection is it's an invasion of her privacy, which is an entirely different matter.
And it's a matter that's prompted Naomi to take the issue to Britain's High Court. Her legal action is possible thanks to European privacy laws that Britain has recently adopted. She's being represented in the case by lawyers Schilling and Lom Partners. Simon Smith is managing partner at the firm.
The new privacy law is based upon Article 8 of the European Convention for the Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms. Therefore, from the 2nd of October 2000, media lawyers had a new weapon. They could go to court and say that a particular story should be stopped, restrained from publication on the grounds that it would be an infringement of their client's privacy.
At the Daily Mirror's sister title, The Sunday People, editor Neil Wallace is outraged by the Naomi Campbell case. He says her actions stink of hypocrisy.
What you have here is this incredible double standards. Naomi Campbell has posed naked in books. She poses with no clothes on along the catwalks around the world. She will do anything to get her name in the paper. And yet suddenly, she wants to turn the tap off.
But, says media lawyer Simon Smith, the same human rights legislation that protects individuals' privacy also has provisions that favour the newspapers.
On the flip side, the journalists would point out that the convention also has Article 10, which entitles anyone to freedom of expression. And so it's a balancing exercise on each occasion between the two directly competing freedoms or rights.
The trouble is that it'll be up to judges to perform this legal balancing act on a case-by-case basis behind closed doors, well away from Parliament and elected politicians. Hardly a democratic process. All bad news for editor Neil Wallace back at the Sunday People. He's sick of constantly struggling against what he sees as increasingly draconian restrictions against the media.
They are slowly, steadily bringing in choking, censorship and privacy laws. And the outrageous thing is, it isn't to protect Joe Public, it's to protect the rich and famous.
The journalist is complaining because his freedom of expression is being fettered or restrained by these new laws.
Media lawyer Simon Smith.
And that journalist would be the first to reach for the privacy rights. But I think we all have to look after the individual who can be exploited and targeted by a much bigger force. And I think the courts are best placed to judge when that point arises, and not the editor of a newspaper who openly flouts the law.
And tabloid expert Chris Horry says it's not just legislative changes that are altering the tabloid landscape.
The British tabloids are incredibly blanded out compared with what they used to be. They used to be absolutely red in tooth and claw. They used to be absolutely out of control, day in, day out. You know, wildly exaggerated stories, unbelievable political bias, so biased it was actually funny. Really quite savage and nasty, intrusive reporting into people's lives. They've had to stop all that. Partly, probably their audience has changed. More people now go to university in this country. We're becoming a more middle-class country. So all this kind of very down-market, aggressive stuff no longer really works.
Meanwhile, about a third of the British population regularly picks up a tabloid, nearly twice as many as read the so-called quality press. The High Court is due to deliver its verdict in the Naomi Campbell versus the Daily Mirror case at the end of the month. But even if Naomi wins, it'll be a long time before celebs have nothing to fear from the long lens and the scoop-hungry tabloid news hound. For On the Media, this is Gareth Mitchell in London.
For some readers of the august New York Times, there's nothing more perversely satisfying than catching an embarrassing gaffe in its pages. Yes, the Times does make mistakes. Actually, an average of 7 a day, that's about 2,500 a year. Times editors Dylan Loeb McLean and Linda Amster collected some of their favorite errors and put them in a new book called Kill Duck Before Serving. I had to ask them, why so many mistakes?
There are 138,000 words every day in the paper on average, and 317,000 on Sundays. And when you have, obviously, you're publishing so much, it's almost a given that you're going to make at least some errors. Because everybody makes mistakes. We just put it in a place where everybody can see them.
And actually, I think that after the Times started putting its corrections in a specific place every day and made it a regular part of the paper that was easy to find, other papers followed suit. So in a way, we spearheaded that.
Given that all of these, the numbers you have are fluid, what is the most common error? Is there one?
I'd say probably a spelling.
It's got to be spellings. Mm-hmm.
And what is the most common misspelling?
Well, I think the Edgar Allan Poe was up there.
Allen and Allan Poe.
Yes. We also got Philip Morris, the name of the company, wrong.
That's a question of one L in the Philip or two?
Yes
exactly. We counted up 128 times, and that's not necessarily all of them. That just means at least that many.
Another correction that pattern that we find is in terms of a chapter, sorry, wrong number.
You want to give me a handy example?
The one that begins the chapter is one of our favorites, which is the Ivana Trump one. An article about Ivana Trump and her spending habits misstated the number of bras she buys. It is 2 dozen black, 2 dozen beige, and 2 dozen white. not 2,000 of each.
You know, I saw that. That was the subject of some considerable conversation in certain circles in New York.
When you saw it without the correction, you mean.
Exactly. People said, can this be true?
Another one, which is one of my favorites in that chapter, is a chart listing the projected cost of closing the Air Force Laboratory in Rome, New York, misdated the October 13th, 1994 estimate of how much space would be needed for a new location for the lab. It is 328,000 square feet, not 0.328.
And I'll just give you one more. It was about the size of Leonard Bernstein's, the dimensions of his Bösendorfer grand piano, and we had to hasten to say that it was 7 feet 4 inches in length, not in height.
Some of the mistakes are so just plain whack. You really can't understand how they could have been made. This is one from June of 2001. A column about restaurants in Beijing misidentified Shen Shuanghai, owner of the home that is now the Bamboo Garden Hotel, site of the Drunken Beauty Veranda restaurant. A reader's email pointed out that Mr. Shen was a prominent businessman and government official. He was not the Qing Dynasty Palace eunuch who designed the gardens.
So close. So close.
Sometimes they're a little hard to explain. Excised in most cases the reasons why sometimes corrections get delayed and compiled them in the last chapter. The New York Times tries as quickly as possible to get a correction put into the paper so that people will hopefully see it who have read the article recently. Sometimes, for a variety of reasons, the corrections are not put into the paper as quickly as they should be.
Do you happen to remember offhand what is the longest delay between an error being made and it being corrected?
Funny you should mention that one. That's actually one of my absolute favorite ones. June 17th, 1969, there was a special edition of the paper put out to commemorate the landing on the moon. And as part of that special section, there was the following, which was labeled a correction. On January 13, 1920, Topics of the Times, an editorial page feature of the New York Times, dismissed the notion that a rocket could function in a vacuum and comments as follows. Further investigation and experimentation have confirmed the findings of Isaac Newton in the 17th century, and it is now definitely established that a rocket can function in a vacuum as well as in an atmosphere. The Times regrets the error.
Well, my goodness, though, that sounds like a commentary, and if the Times set out to correct all prognostications, there would be no Times. It would all be corrections.
Yeah, yes, true. Knowledge does change, but I think there was also something wonderful about the idea that the paper is able and willing to kind of go back into its own history and see what the paper has said before and say, you know, we weren't quite right.
I want to thank you both very much for coming up and talking to us about Kill Duck Before Serving.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Linda Amster and Dylan Loeb McLean are the authors of Kill Duck Before Serving, Red Faces at the New York Times. This is a compilation of some of the Gray Lady's more memorable mistakes.
Coming up, magazines use shady means to retain subscribers, and advertisers use a shaky premise to overvalue young consumers.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Only 2 years after being pressured by government officials to stop using misleading "You May Be a Winner" sweepstakes in its magazine sales efforts, Time Inc. may again be pushing the legal envelope in its direct mail operation. On the Media has learned that the Florida Attorney General's office recently informed Time that it has serious concerns about the legality of some of the company's marketing practices. That preliminary evaluation comes in the midst of a 17-month investigation into the way that Time Inc. sells its publications, including Money, Sports Illustrated, Fortune, and Time. Among the possible infractions, a lack of clear and conspicuous disclosure on bills, a pattern of threatening collection letters for unfounded subscription charges, and the use of look-alike sales pitches disguised as invoices. This week, the Attorney General's office plans to subpoena Time's billing records and materials that the company has thus far been unwilling to turn over voluntarily. On the Media's John Solomon reports.
After a year of subscribing to Money magazine, 76-year-old Jack Eldridge of Plano, Texas, decided not to renew. But soon after the expiration date, Eldridge began receiving increasingly urgent overdue notices. Chalking it up to computer error, he ignored the correspondence. That is, until he received a letter threatening, quote, further serious collection activities against you by Time Inc., including being placed in the Time Inc. bad debt file. That scared Eldridge enough that he sent in a check, along with his own letter, demanding that they stop sending the magazine.
I have a good credit rating, and I didn't want to sally by such a cheap shot.
Computer error was not responsible for filling Eldridge's mailbox. Instead, it turns out that he had unwittingly agreed to join Time's preferred subscriber's automatic renewal program, which obligated him to a continuous subscription until he canceled it. Though it is a major change from the traditional magazine billing method, Eldridge would only have figured out he'd been signed up by seeing the small type, obliquely worded explanation hidden far down in the original bill. Florida Assistant Attorney General Victoria Butler says this level of disclosure may violate state law.
It's reasonable to hold a consumer to the terms of an offer that they accepted if those terms are made clearly and conspicuously and responsibly to the consumer. It's not reasonable to hold them to an obligation that the company is tricking them into.
Butler, who is based in Tampa, where Time circulation operations are headquartered, has received hundreds of similar complaints from across the U.S. Based on previous experience in consumer cases, she believes that may just be the tip of the iceberg. Many are from long-time subscribers who say Time changed the renewal terms without their knowledge and then hounded them for payment when they let their subscriptions expire.
We're talking about 6, 7, 8 months of pointed collection notices that get increasingly threatening, this Time Warner bad debt database, this black cloud on their name. Nobody quite understands the full implications of that. I mean, that threat is very real and very serious as far as what the company is doing under the law.
Automatic renewal is an attempt by the Time Magazine Group to change its billing to the continuous service model used by sister AOL Time Warner businesses such as cable and internet service. From a business point of view, it is understandable why Time would want to change the renewal process. The trouble, from a legal standpoint, is that the company is not telling their subscribers about the change, except in fine print. And they are never explicitly asked whether they prefer to be preferred subscribers. Time spokesperson Peter Castiglio did not want to be interviewed on air, but told On the Media that there's nothing illegal or wrong with the company's sales practices. Castiglio says that automatic renewal is clearly explained on bills and points out that the complaints make up just a fraction of the magazine group's total subscribers. Further, he says, it is easy for customers to cancel their subscriptions, no questions asked. Butler agrees that Time is responsive to customers when they call to complain. The problem is that the company will not modify the policy that is generating the confusion.
It's not right what they're doing because they're taking advantage of people who don't read the fine print or who are easily confused. Whether or not it was illegal, it felt unethical, definitely.
To former customer service representative Chris Durham, Time is making a calculation that there are enough people like Jack Eldridge who will respond to pressure tactics by just paying up. Durham says that most of the calls he took during the 7 months he worked at Time's Tampa call center in 2000 were from consumers bewildered as to why they were getting collection letters.
We got a lot of people calling up and saying, hey, my grandma has subscriptions to Sports Illustrated. Why is that?
Victoria Butler says the answer may lie in another Time marketing technique: direct mail sales pieces made to look like invoices. She's looking into whether they are being sent out by Time without the requisite 30-point boldface no-obligation disclaimer mandated by Florida law. John S. Reed, a retired police officer, says he was almost fooled by one such look-alike pitch from Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, I'm 64 years old myself, and I'm fairly sharp, I think, yet, and I can see where some people that have physical and mental problems when they get into our age group, and some of them would ordinarily pay this. And Time Life is a big enough corporation that they don't have to stoop to this type of practice in order to get money from people.
If Time is found to be in violation of Florida law, it could incur significant fines and be forced to provide refunds. The company also faces a private lawsuit filed by a subscriber in Tampa, which will likely become a class action. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
I went to an advanced screening of a special broadcast CBS has planned to mark the 6-month anniversary of the disaster called 9/11. The 2-hour program is built around striking footage gathered that day by French filmmakers Jules and Gideon Naudet. The brothers were working on a film about the 9-month training of a firefighter recruit. He waited months for his crack at a fire. And then, of course, came that sunny morning in September when the world changed. Are you weary of that phrase, when the world changed? How about the defining moment of our time, or a day they will never forget? You'll hear them all in the CBS presentation of 9/11 Sunday night. That isn't to say it isn't a remarkable document, a living historical document, just as its network producers declare it to be. For the first time, all those who lived the horror secondhand can see it as the firefighters did, from the very lobby of Tower One, can hear the gut-wrenching crash of falling bodies from the upper floors, can glimpse something of what it's like to be nearly buried under debris. Nor does the film sensationalize. We don't see those falling bodies, the burning bodies, or the body parts recovered in the aftermath. It does not sensationalize, but it does, in some measure, exploit, because the producers and editors do not trust us. After all we've seen the last 6 months and all we've heard, they still insist on spelling it out, with host Robert De Niro in slow motion and melancholy music, even at one point a choir to recall us to the presence of a higher power. These devices are used sparingly, the producers point out, to make transitions and to say the things that needed to be said. But those things don't need to be said. The material is powerful enough, requiring none of the medium's traditional trappings to command our attention. 9/11 belongs to all of us, and I would have preferred if TV had, for once, just once, not told me what I'm supposed to feel.
Commercial television is about the purest expression of democracy this country has to offer. Programming decisions are made by what is very nearly a direct referendum, in which all of America votes every day with its eyeballs. But here's the strange thing. In TV democracy, for all practical purposes, if you are 35 years old or more, your vote doesn't count. This we have learned from the latest late-night controversy, in which ABC is wooing David Letterman to replace Ted Koppel's Nightline. Not because Letterman has a bigger audience, he doesn't, but because he has a younger audience, prized by advertisers. The Nightline debacle is the latest and most vivid evidence of Madison Avenue's strange obsession with the demographic group, 64 million strong, of 18 to 34s.
There are basically two reasons why this 18 to 34-year-olds are this coveted demographic.
Seema Nayyar is editor of American Demographics magazine.
From a brand loyalty standpoint, they're less loyal to a particular product and more willing to try new products, or so the thinking goes, and then they're generally thought of as just more susceptible to advertising. The other reason this demo is so coveted is what marketers call its lifelong value proposition.
In English, that means seeking out the brand unloyal for advertisers to mold in their own images. David Verklin, CEO of Cara International, a media buying company that spends $4.5 billion a year on advertising, explains the concept.
They haven't made all their brand choices, particularly the younger side of that spectrum. And if you can reach them and get them to be users of your brand at an early age, you'll have them for a lifetime.
Beyond that, Verklin says, targeting younger consumers is a good way to aim for the middle, between baby boomers on the one end and teenagers on the other. Furthermore, he says, the youth market is so attractive because it so vastly influences the entire consumer population's buying behavior. Just as inner-city black teenagers are on the vanguard of what eventually will be shopping mall culture.
Let's talk about the rap culture's influence on really suburban youth. But let's talk about Nike and its belief that the basketball court on West 4th Street is the epicenter of the Nike brand. I think it's a pretty well-accepted proposition that you have, circles of influence that emanate from a central point.
Anyway, that's the theory. Almost none of this is supported by empirical evidence. Even Verklin calls the brand loyalty rationale an old chestnut. But these behavioral assumptions generate huge premiums to reach a demographic of viewers whose median income is 35% less than baby boomers and who represent 38% less of the population.
I'm not sure that a lot of this stuff is grounded in anything but people's kind of wispy theories.
Betsy Carter is editor of My Generation, a new magazine distributed by the American Association of Retired Persons to 4 million baby boomer households.
If Madison Avenue is about money and about business, there's some disconnect here in that sort of the business logic. If you're going to follow the money is with this generation.
She is hard-pressed to understand why Madison Avenue is obsessed with 18 to 34s to the exclusion of boomers, the wealthiest demographic segment in the history of commerce. For instance, there are 104 million Americans aged 35 to 64 versus only 64 million in the magic 18 to 34 cohort, and they have a lot more money. American demographics, Seema Nayyar.
Today, there are 25 million households under the age of 35. The total aggregate income of those under the age of 35 is $1.3 trillion, whereas there are 46 million households between the ages of 35 to 54 today, and they have an aggregate income of $3 trillion. So you have almost double the number of households in the older group and almost triple the amount of aggregate income. So really, which group do you want to target, the 25 million households with $1 trillion worth of income or the 46 million households with $3 trillion in income?
As for the supposition that 18 to 34s are more likely to experiment with advertised brands, she says,
as far as I know, it's just based on a hunch. It's based on this old idea of, you know, the younger, cooler 18 to 34 demographic as being the, you know, the hot demo to be in.
That's what makes magazine editor Betsy Carter so frustrated. Not only advertising and programming's preoccupation with younger audiences, but the fashion industry, which designs pricey clothes for young people, she says, can't afford to wear them, and presumes she will leave the house in nude hosiery and sensible brown shoes.
Even if we're going to wake up tomorrow and wear nude hose and sensible shoes, we've got to get the sensible shoes someplace.
That's why she believes 18 to 34 mania will not stand. At some point, the way she figures it, advertisers will have to put their mouths where the money is.
It's a question of who's going to break through and who's going to advertise to this market and who's going to break through and say this market is important to us and we're going to court them and we're going to advertise and they're going to make a whole lot of money when they do it.
Or not. Scott Donatan, editor of Advertising Age and my boss, recalls not long ago when CBS tried to position its relatively geriatric audience as the well-to-do advertisers' Valhalla.
CBS in about the mid to late 1990s found itself with the oldest demographic of any of the leading TV networks. NBC had Friends and they were getting the young audience, and CBS's hit show was Murder, She Wrote. So CBS basically set about trying to convince advertisers that this audience was a great audience, had more spending power, but advertisers didn't buy it. And in the end, CBS put Survivor on the air and went back to the younger audience.
So marketers and programmers continue to chase the children of the Carter administration, not because there are so many of them, but, strangely enough, because there are so few. In the sort of logic that scans only on Madison Avenue, the very difficulty of getting a critical mass of young adults to put down their snowboards and laptops long enough to watch TV makes a program that attracts them disproportionately valuable. David Letterman's audience averages only 4 years younger than Ted Koppel's and is on average 10% smaller, but a 30-second commercial on The Late Show fetches 38% more.
In addition to the Letterman for Koppel swap, ABC News is youthening its Sunday chat show this week. Cokie Roberts will no longer host, and USA Today reports that Sam Donaldson will also go. Replacing that venerable duo whose average age is 63 will be Claire Shipman and George Stephanopoulos, average age close to 40. On the media wondered, what if another Sunday chat show decided it too would make a grab for a younger audience? A much younger audience.
Issue the first. Will President George W. Bush protect domestic steel interests at the expense of our fragile international coalition against terrorism? Newsweek's Eleanor Clift.
It's a false choice. The WTO is going to...
Wrong! Timmy O'Connell, age 10.
Steel Coalition?
Laughable! Ashley Bing, age 9, Jefferson Elementary.
I didn't have my hand raised.
Socratic method used here. Joshua Lifner, age 8, enjoys his pet dog Bongo. A steel sellout?
You're mean.
You don't know mean until you've seen Jack Jamond on a 3-day bender. Next question, who would win in a fight, the Powerpuff Girls or Wrestling's The Rock? Joshua?
The Rock.
Timmy O'Connell?
Definitely The Rock.
Eleanor Clift?
Well, as long as the ICRC were able to officiate and ensure the...
Wrong! The Powerpuff Girls are unlawful combatants. Ashley Bing!
There are 3 Powerpuff Girls, so maybe they'd win.
Wrong! The Powerpuff Girls, while a triumvirate, will surely incur the wrath not only of The Rock, but his broad-shouldered cohorts, Triple H and The Undertaker. Predictions! Will Pokemon come back? Joshua!
No.
Ashley?
I don't think so.
Eleanor?
It could.
Pokemon is a they, not an it. Timmy!
I traded all my Pokemon cards for a Derek Jeter rookie card, and now the Jeter rookie card is worth more now.
Trenchant on your part. The answer is no. Pokemon and Prime Minister Koizumi's government will be gone by summer, and nothing will touch the staying power of Hello Kitty.
I love Hello Kitty.
Of course you do. You adorable, adorable girl.
I have a Hello Kitty lunchbox.
Too late, Eleanor. We're replacing you with a singing turtle. Out of time. Bye-bye.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by Scott Strickland and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Jim Colgan, Lou Olkowski, Jocelyn Gonzalez, Jen Sloan, and ladies and gentlemen, in the role of Joshua, Miss Allison Garfield. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Shameless. Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment, How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.